Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Do you know that every car comes with a chair of stories? That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, the luxury package you got after a big promotion, or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few simple questions. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas. Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
A lot of people say don't meet your heroes. I can say that that is a good statement for most people. But in this episode, I actually got to sit down with one of my heroes. Walter Hill is an incredibly accomplished writer. He's been writing for nearly 50 years. He has written some of my favorite movies, and he has been involved with, directed, or produced a good deal of my favorite movies, which include Warriors, Alien, and 48 Hours. He directed the pilot for Deadwood, and he is just an incredible, incredible filmmaker. And he has created something that goes back to an old form, which is a story told in the spoken word. And he has created a beautiful story out of the Cowboy Iliad, which is based on a true story of a famous gunfight. And he has taken his words and he has laid them down in his own voice and had music added and sound effects. And it is just an immersive, incredible, incredible story that the writing is just sublime. If you want to listen to great, great writing and just hear how a masterful screenwriter writes not only dialogue, but the description, then I highly recommend downloading it as soon as you can. This was an incredible experience for me because I really got to deep dive into the making and creation of both 48 Hours and Alien. I could have spoken to Walter all day. Unfortunately, we didn't have all day. We only had an hour. I tried to cram in as much as I could in that hour, and I hope that if you're fans of either of those movies or Warriors or Deadwood, that you enjoy this podcast.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hey, this is Jordan Harbinger, host of the not-so-creatively titled Jordan Harbinger Show. We dig into the superpowers of the world's most interesting thinkers, and then we deliver them to you right into your ears. It's more than just a way to get inspired, and I get it. We're not all superheroes. That's why we give you their blueprint and include worksheets for every episode, as well as answer your listener questions so you can live what you listen. Listen free to the Jordan Harbinger Show, available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
All right, I'm here with Walter Hill. Hello, Mr. Hill.
Hello.
I have to say, I've done a number of these, and I have not yet used the word legend in my podcast. And you, sir, are a legend. I am a gigantic fan. I'm so honored that you're here. I really am. Not only have you been a producer and a writer director for over nearly 50 years, but you've made, honestly, some of my favorite movies. You wrote The Getaway. These are just a few of my absolute all-star favorites. You wrote The Getaway. You wrote and directed Warriors. You wrote and directed 48 Hours, Streets of Fire, Wild Bill, and you produced Alien. Those stats to me, as someone who grew up watching those and those movies affecting me, it's just been an incredible career. So thank you for doing that for me specifically.
Well, you're too kind in your introduction.
Now, you are really well known for incredibly detailed, incredible action, a lot of comedy, and I would hasten to say you are very attracted to the Western genre, which is so weird that it's even a genre to me. Westerns to me just feel like a place where great stories could be set. Do you agree, or do you think it's actually a genre?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. People sometimes say, well, you know, you've made Westerns, and it must be fun to be out there with the horses, and you do the 19th century, most of them are 19th century, historical situations and Western stories. And I would say, yeah, but and all that's true. And they are as much fun to make as anything gets to be, I think. But the stories are really kind of Old Testament stories.
Right.
I mean, they're older and, shall I say, deeper than the form of the Western. They kind of touch into something even more basic, I think.
And I would say, and please correct me if I'm wrong, in terms of the Western, in terms of the archetypes, and in terms of what you're interested in writing, if you look at The Getaway and Warriors and 48 Hours, I mean, those are Westerns. When I watch 48 Hours, the shots that you did and the way that you structured that screenplay, including coming down to a duel at the end, you know, between Nolte and the bad guy, and also just the bus being like a train and the car coming up like horses. You grew up in Long Beach. It's not like you grew up in Texas. So what early on inspired you in these Western archetypes and these tropes to be so interested that it infused all your early work?
Well, I can see that I haven't disguised my methods.
I'm sorry.
Sufficiently,
I'm a geek. I'm sorry. I'm a geek of this stuff. I really
I'm more transparent than I realize.
We haven't even gotten into Alien or Warriors yet.
The first thing I'd say is down in Long Beach when I grew up, we were surrounded by the rural, and in a very funny way, we were kind of – it was a Navy town. It was a town of a lot of people from the South and Midwest, made up most of the population of Long Beach when I was down there. I lived in the North Long Beach part. My grandparents had small dwellings, but at the same time, they had land and they had chickens and ducks and turkeys. And I think I said before, the guy used to rent the field next door and keep his mule. So I was around country ways, shall we say, a great deal.
Yeah, people forget that. I was telling you before we started this, I grew up in San Fernando. I'm a fourth generation San Fernando kid. And I can even remember orange groves as far as the eye could see and dirt roads even in my generation. So, I mean, that's what people forget is that California was a Western town.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of it was rural in those days. I'm a deal older than you, but I remember when cold snaps, the smudge pots, half of Orange County would put the smudge pots out next to the orange trees, and it would just blacken the skies.
Wow. Keep them warm.
Trying to keep the oranges, from freezing.
Do you remember early on specific stories that inspired you to go on to, like, for example, like The Getaway? Like, you came out of the gate writing these incredibly specific, complicated characters that were not really black or white, but always had shades of gray.
I came of a generation, I think we were influenced a lot by what we used to call foreign films, the French New Wave and the Swedish films, and in my case particularly the Italian films and the Japanese films. I always thought that genre filmmaking, I always say this, genre needs no defense. They're the best stories. But that you were going to have to do something a lot less straightforward than had been the way you could tell stories maybe 20 years before. So I kept trying to push the genres maybe in different directions, and I was always kind of interested in the dilemma of those that try to live up to certain masculine attitudes and the problems they therefore discover themselves caught up in. So, but all those kind of questions tend to be a little deep for me. I try to tell a story, you know, and well, it's a funny thing. You know, you do this for a living, too. We make films. We tell stories on film. It's a different kind of writing.
Yeah.
The dialogue, whether it's meant to be realistic or stylized. You discover very early on all dialogue is stylized. It's whatever kind of patterns you're trying to emulate. And the audience attitudes are very different, I think, than fictional literature. The great South American writer Borges once said that and I think he was on to something, that the audience for film drama wants to discover an old story, rediscover and relive an old story, and the anticipation of the dance and the structure of the drama. They know before they go in whether they're going to see a happy ending or a... One of the dilemmas, I mean, if you write action thrillers, let's say you're writing a Clint Eastwood movie, you know Clint in the old days, you know, the Dirty Harry days and all that, you know Clint's going to win.
Right.
The task becomes, how do you tell this story and get everybody heated up about the narrative progression and what Harry's dilemmas are? But at the same time, you'd have a riot in the theater if Eastwood lost. You know what I mean?
Right.
Everybody knows right. what the outcome is going
right.
to be, which kind of works against the, you know, the open slate idea that we're just telling stories. And these are stories with foregone conclusions, I would say, at least in half of films, film genres. But that's, if you can do them properly, that's half the fun for
right.
the audience.
Right about now, for people that are listening, they're probably thinking two things. One is that you have the most incredible voice. And number two, that you are an incredible storyteller and writer of film and television. Having had, I'm going to segue real quick, and then I want to come back to your history and your directing, but I want to segue to your latest project, which is called The Cowboy Iliad, A Legend Told in the Spoken Word. And this is an incredible project because I have had the absolute pleasure of reading a Walter Hill screenplay. And the thing that when you, like you just said, the filmic language and you as a director, when it goes on screen, the writing disappears and really people just are listening to the dialogue. And what has always blown me away about your writing is the incredibly complex depth of which you explain the characters, who they are, their motivations, what they look like, and you just immerse the reader. Every time I read one of your screenplays, I was completely immersed in the world even before you directed it. And what you've done in this Cowboy Iliad is you have written a story. I still can't figure out if it's true or not because you kept changing every time. The entire time you kept saying it's true, then it's not, then legend should be fact. And you've recorded it and you've produced it with sound effects and music. It's just such an incredible thing. And so for anybody who has not read a Walter Hill screenplay, let me just play 1 minute of this. And you can hear in the description of the way you describe your characters what it's like to read Walter Hill.
On the night of August 19th, Mike McCluskey went to do some gambling at Perry Tuttle's dance hall. He was accompanied by another railroad man, a friend named Martin, Jim Martin. McCluskey sat in on a poker game for about an hour, then moved on to the faro table. Around that time, three of the newly arrived Texas Cowboys entered the crowded dance hall. They were Billy Garrett, Henry Kearns, Jim Wilkerson. Maybe 10 minutes later, Hugh Anderson arrived. Anderson was another Texan, a cowhand, and it turned out another good friend of William Bailey. Hugh Anderson joined his three friends at the long bar, ordered a whiskey of his own. He wanted a double and he got it. Hugh Anderson was 22 years old. All smiles, the Texans clinked glasses, sipped their whiskey. Mike McCluskey just kept playing faro. Jim Martin kept an eye out, watching the Texans. An out-of-tune piano kept playing.
in a movie that's like 10 seconds. You just would, you would show all these different things. And that's the thing about your writing that's so incredible. And that's why your movies are classics, is just that depth and that texture. I mean, just listening to that gave me chills. You can absolutely see that scene. I don't even know what Pharaoh is. I'm assuming it's like roulette. But
No, Pharaoh's a card game. It's really more like 21. You're
okay.
Betting on what cards turn up. The dealer turns cards over.
Explain to me like the idea for this and the want to do it and to record it for yourself and what this is doing for you that maybe even movies or television couldn't do.
Well, it's a bit of a windy story. I don't know how interesting it is to a lot of people, but I have a very good friend, Bobby Woods, who's in the music business and also has at his, shall we say, his command, an orchestra, a rather remarkable orchestra made up of largely studio musicians, session musicians, and gifted amateurs. They don't play too many dates. They occasionally play in Europe, but they get together and they build up a repertoire of releases. You know, you can find them on YouTube and things like that. Anyway, Bobby and I have dinner a lot, and he's he's a rather large personality, and some of it was alcohol induced, I think.
Some of the best ideas are.
Some of the best ideas are, and we were talking about what, when I was a kid, there were these category of records that would come out, spoken word. I remember Walter Brennan did one about a mule, and John Wayne used to do one every once in a while, and various, and then actually into the 1970s, Red Solvine on the country and western, he'd do them about truck drivers and things like that. But it's, I asked if there was anything still being done in that vein. And he basically said no, because the music business is so restructured now. I mean,
sure.
You know, what we knew as a kid doesn't – I can't even go to Tower Records anymore.
Right.
You know, I used to go there with my daughters. And so anyway, somehow out of all this, he challenged me that if I would write something, he'd supply the music. And I guess what I was trying to do, it's not quite a radio show because it only has a narrator. It doesn't have other actors.
Right.
But it has score – and it has sound effects, so that you're kind of into this category. I'm not sure what it is,
mm-hmm.
and I don't claim to have invented something new, but I haven't heard anything kind of that uses that pattern of instrument, shall we say. So I sat down, and I was interested. I was just really going to do the part about the duel, which was a story I knew. It was based on a newspaper story that had appeared in the New York World in 1873. It was a recounting of a extraordinarily violent duel that was in the what they used to call the Indian Territory, now Oklahoma, which was fueled by revenge for a gunfight that had happened a couple years before in Kansas. And I was just really going to do the story of this duel, the newspaper story. And I did a little research about what the story was behind the story, and I got interested in that part of it. And so suddenly, when I started putting all this down and trying to organize it, I thought, well, you know, this is running a little longer than I thought. And but then I got the real moment, I think, came when I said to myself, what the hell are we doing here? You know, these drunken bozos 150 years ago got into a horrendous gunfight in a bar, shot the shit out of each other, killed and crippled each other. There became a long newspaper account of the aftermath. And here we are fascinated by this stuff. And there are aspects of the story that are very true, and there are aspects of the story that are not factual, shall we say. And in the reports, I'm not talking even about my approach. So I got to where I was even more interested in what – not only did the story have a kind of classical progression, but it seemed to me to be such an old kind of story that it was the kind of story people told around campfires or – that kind of thing, or I knew one of these guys or some, you know, one of those things. Then I got interested in the very human fascination for this kind of simple, hopefully elegant, extraordinarily violent story. That impulse has survived ever since we came out of the caves, I suppose. So I wax a little on that part of it at the end, but most of it's just a fairly straightforward rendition of what happened that night in the Perry Tuttle's dance hall, which was a gunfight four times bigger than the OK Corral,
right.
But it's not as well known. And very true. I mean, that's a true.
But the way you describe it and go into the detail of the violence and the specifics of what each bullet does and who each guy was and what kind of personality was is so rich and deep. We'll tell everybody how to get it at the end. I just encourage people to listen to it. Anybody who loves good writing should listen to this. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, I'm very pleased that you say that. I do come out of a tradition, I guess, that's now – some of us don't fit into the Marvel superhero world, mm-hmm. but we were action directors. I'm not complaining. I've had a chance to do a lot of work in my time. But the fashions have changed. And I come out of a tradition where we had a little watchword that the jokes are funny, but the bullets are real. So I don't like to do things where you don't see or feel the consequences of violence. And as people currently are saying, elections have consequences.
Right.
Well, when you pick up a gun, there are quite often consequences. Consequences can be positive occasionally, but...
Right.
If you're going after, you know, World War II or something, and but the bullets are real.
That's a perfect segue because I want to talk to you about your directing. All of your movies, even the sound effects of the guns in the Cowboy Iliad, are very similar to the sound effects of your guns in 48 Hours and Warriors and all these movies. And even in 48 Hours, he carries a 45. And in the war, and in Wild Bill, the guns are not like pop, 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 pop. They're like these deep, resonating, violent, and you explain the violence very, very, very well. And in all your movies, and I want to talk about when you talk about Marvel movies and today's filmmaking, I would just love to talk about you as a director, because the other thing you did, and again, I hope I'm not revealing your tricks, you love to follow characters and not cut. And it wasn't like you were doing like a, you know, long shot like in, you know, like Scorsese does in Goodfellas. You follow your lead character and you stay with them and you watch the reaction as they're walking over to get the clue, or the character in the Warriors or Wild Bill. You didn't use cuts and close-ups to say emotion. You stayed with your characters and kind of panned and dollied with them as they went. And the way you shot your action was very visceral, and you always have really long shots. You didn't, like, you know, have to cut and cut away and cut away. And also had your characters really walk towards the camera in long shots while they're talking, so you could really see a sense of place and geography. All of that being said, that's not the way people make movies anymore. So walk me through you as a director at that time making those movies and kind of what your film language was and kind of how you put them all together.
Well, that's a hard one. Look, I think about directing is, in the end, it's just about your taste. It's whatever seems appropriate for the story you're telling, your taste in the choice of the story you're telling, your taste in the pictorial composition or the lighting or the way you edit. Or, I mean, it's just all – and it's really kind of – I don't know what else to say other than it just seemed appropriate to me for the story I was trying to tell. So basically the question becomes, why are we the way we are? And I have no idea. You grew up in the Valley, and I was from Long Beach. And there were a lot of other people down in Long Beach that didn't decide to become movie directors. So, you know, it's kind of hard to say what the answers are other than it's your taste. It's what you feel is appropriate. Sometimes you can't really explain it. It just seems to be the right thing. And sometimes it's so complicated you absolutely don't want to. I know I was at Cannes one year with a film, and Mr. Kurosawa was there with his film, and he gave an interview, and they asked him what his film meant, and he said, you know, in translation, he said, if I could reduce it down to a couple of sentences, I'd write it down and wear it on a card around my neck. That way I wouldn't have to answer these stupid questions.
Right. Is
the interview process is always difficult because the nature of an interview is necessarily reductionist.
Right.
You know, you want a simpler, clear-cut answer for the people that happen to be listening. That's only fair. We all understand that. But at the same time, it's just difficult. You know, it's why are films so different? You know, different directors, different writers make very different stylistic choices.
But were you influenced? You said you were influenced by some of the foreign films, but were you influenced by Western specifically, or like?
Oh, sure.
And so when do you think that infused, do you think that infused into your work, such as in The Warriors and Streets of Fire and things like that?
I think so. But I think it's the, I always felt, I'm not used to talking about the origins.
Sorry. This is what I do.
I do think
I really want to know.
I always felt what I wanted to do was to tell simple stories in a complicated way. I think that's very cinematic.
Yeah.
I think really complicated narratives, you lose the audience. That's really much more of a literary function where you can flip back and check,
right?
You know, and but a movie, the audience is a prisoner of the narrative progression and the character progression, and they don't get to go back and try to get it straight in their heads or something. Although that's kind of reasoning from the outside in. And I think I just felt that instinctively, that I grew up with movies. I grew up as a good reader. I spend at least half my time reading. But the there's something about the need for simple comprehension about film that is part of the audience experience. There's just a need for clarity. What makes audiences furious, especially American audiences, is lack of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who is it? Why? What happened? You know, and it really irritates them.
The other thing I love about you as a director and a writer is that you as the writer could write, as you heard by the Cowboy Iliad, these really interesting, complex action and description. But you as the director never were verbose in terms of wrapping up a character or solving a problem. I know I keep going back to 48 Hours, and I'm sorry. But like even in 48 Hours, when Nick Nolte rides Eddie Murphy and he's racist to him and he puts him down, there's just one brief moment where Nolte goes, "Hey, man, I didn't mean that stuff I said. You know, I'm just trying to keep you down." And then Eddie says, "Hey, you know, sometimes that doesn't justify the means." That was it. Like, and in that brief moment of these guys, they completely got each other. You didn't go as a writer and have this long soliloquy for each of them making up. That was beautiful. And so did you feel like, as a director, you sometimes had to kind of fire the writer? Or when you were you directing already?
I don't know. Look, I have certain maxims that I've tried to live up to, I think, interior.
What are those?
One is don't overstate. You know, I see films where they say the same thing 15 goddamn times. I mean, it's just don't overstate it and try to have confidence in what you're doing in the and don't sell out your characters. Well, one, let's go back to another maxim. Every good story ends with a tear, even comedies. I think Hemingway once said this probably best, was that every love story has a sad ending. Somebody dies first. The two characters that Nick and Eddie played, it would be dishonest to suggest that they were going to be buddies forever, that they were going to go off to some kind of movie land and be linked, you know, open a bar together, something right. like that. They were who they were, and they knew that they had shared a moment and that the moment was ending and that they would go back to their separate lives. And they were both kind of touched by it, but at the same time, they knew who they were. So there's a touch of melancholy to their parting, say, at the end of the movie. But again, try not to overstate these things. And if you make the audience work a little, you know, they'll like it better.
That's great advice.
Because they share it rather than you just telling them.
Right. And so you were a writer first, then a director.
I was.
And then a writer, director, producer. And then you also just produce things like Alien. What was the logic of the progression of that? So walk me through kind of how Alien came about and how you were brought onto that movie to produce it. Was that like a logical progression for you because you wanted more control, wanted to organize from the beginning more? What was the thought there?
Well, I had a partner, David Giler, and another partner, Gordon Carroll. We formed a company. We had been, you know, it's the usual story. We felt that we had been jacked around a bit here and there. And we thought as a protective device for us, David's writer and director as well. He directed a film. We felt that having our own company, we might be able to protect ourselves a little better in the clinches. And David was good friends with one of the executives at Fox. I had actually just made a deal out at Fox. So it all kind of dovetails. We made a deal out there as a production unit. There was a fellow, I have no idea what's happened to him. His name is Mark Haggard. He brought, and I knew him, he was a great, great devotee of John Ford's movies. And I used to like to talk to Mark about Ford's films. And he knew that I had interest, though, in science fiction and all kinds of things, really. So anyway, he brought me a script. He came to the office one day and he said, he just dropped in and said, here, I think you ought to read this. And it was a screenplay by Dan O'Bannon and Ron Shusett. It was in its formative period, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But it had some good scenes and ideas, and but it was in desperate need of a rewrite. And Fox had already passed on it, actually. They had submitted it there and everything. But David and I agreed that if you fixed the script and made it in a first-class way, it was, again, simple story.
Yeah.
Very simple story. And it had a kind of potentially relentless quality to it that I liked, that there was, and David did as well. So,
and by the way, sorry to interrupt you, that relentlessness, if you go back and look at all your movies, I mean, and again, look at Westerns, it's the posse chasing Butch and Sundance, not that you wrote that, but I'm saying that paradigm of warriors, the guys being chased, 48 hours, you only have 48 hours, they're getting bombarded from every side, you know, Wild Bill, you know the inevitable. That relentlessness, really, you like that. That really puts the pressure on your characters.
I do.
When you first read it, did you see it as like a science fiction movie? Did you see it just as a human story of people trying to survive? What was the thing that sort of...
Well, it was a little different than most of the things I've been involved with, because we saw it as a commercial vehicle.
Right.
The movie was I remember David and I talking about it. It really our inspiration was the old Howard Hawks The Thing.
Yeah.
And we wanted to get that kind of pressure into it. So we developed the script. I did a turn on it, made the Ripley character, they were all men in the old version.
Oh, wow.
But to go to what you said, it was my theory was that it's not really a science fiction movie. The science fiction elements in it are really very crude. It's a horror film disguised as a science fiction movie. And that was the chief reason that I thought going to the female lead was a good idea, because I think horror movies work best when you've got a female protagonist. They certainly did historically at that time. But again, there was an awful lot of outside, what I call outside-in reasoning about the project, much more than, oh, some other things that maybe I wrote or something, where you'd come up with a... You'd think about the character and then the narrative concerns of a character and everything. This was, well, we often say a money job. And and we thought it had a shot at commercial success.
Right.
When we got, yes. Well, we turned out to be.
Your instincts were correct, sir.
Yeah, we turned out to be a hell of a lot more right than we even imagined. We started sending it out. Virtually every director in Hollywood turned it down, except Robert Aldrich. Right, he was the president of the Guild at the time, Directors Guild, and Bob called up. I didn't really know him then, but you guys sent me this script. Yeah, well, go on over here and, right away. Come tomorrow morning. Come, all right, tomorrow afternoon. You know, and we went over and saw him, and he said, "I like this." He said, "It's a good, could be a good film." He said, "It all depends on the monster. Do the monster right, it'll be fine. We can get some actors, you know."
the amount of care and love that is being put into this movie is not lost on me. So let me just pause for 1 second.
Yeah.
First of all, it must have been just thrilling for those guys to work with you as a writer and just to get in there and roll up your sleeves. Because I just had the
Which guys are these?
Well, your writers. Oh, there was nobody else developing? It was just you writing the script
at
this point?
Well, we parted company.
Oh, there, okay. There was, so it wasn't so thrilling for them.
I think not. I know Dan felt very bad about the whole way he got screen credit.
Yeah.
I don't know what...
Your guild protected him.
Yeah, but he... I don't know. He had mixed feelings about the final product, I guess. He had mixed feelings about me and my involvement and David and David's involvement. I don't. He's passed away. I don't want to say anything.
Did you ever think about directing it yourself?
I did think about it, but I really decided that I wasn't right for it because there were too many special effects, and I didn't think I knew how to do them. And special effects were very different then than they are
practical
now.
And puppets and, you know, being able to do angles to hide the puppeteers. And
things. And I just didn't think that was my cup of tea.
And I'm just going to back up 1 second before we get to the production of it. You had Larry Gordon on 4 to 8 hours.
Yeah.
And so what was that like? I mean, he's amazing. I love him. But what did you watch? Oh, that's what a producer does? I mean, you worked with a lot of producers.
Well, Larry produced my first film,
right?
Hard Times.
So you knew him. Like
very
back
well.
Then, what was the producing job back then for those movies?
Well, it was, you know, we made studio movies. I mean, these other than I guess the superhero things, it's not like that so much, and some comedies. But the business has changed so much and so quickly. But it was. You know, he would front the script and go out and beat up various executives and yell at them. I mean, he's an incredible force of nature, as you.
Yeah. I have one.
He's great.
He's amazing.
He's amazing. And so funny.
The best. My favorite Larry Gordon story is we were doing Hellboy together, and he called and he lit me up. That Southern accent just went off on me. And I go, and I, it wasn't even an argument. He was just explaining something. And I said, Larry, why are you yelling at me? And he goes, boy, I don't want to try to do it because I'll embarrass myself. He goes, if I was yelling at you, you would know it. And I was like, holy shit. Thank God Larry's never yelled at me because that would be insane.
Well, he and I got along very well right from the first. And we had a couple little fights, but they were never serious, and we never challenged each other in a deep way. We'd have some fights about the story or something, and he's very good about in the creative.
Oh yeah, you know, very.
Which
you can't have his career. And not
yeah,
be good
which
at it.
Which few producers are. Frankly.
I agree with you.
And Larry's very, very good at that. And he's also, even when furious, he is a great figure of fun. I mean, it's just – it's so funny to watch him in action. And but he's fearless. I so admired – he would disagree with me about something. And sometimes we got into it pretty good. And then he'd go out and fight for me in that very thing.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. And he,
that's such an important lesson for people to learn because he believed in you and believed ultimately if he couldn't persuade you that you were right.
Well, you know,
awesome.
He was built a wall around the production and it was, as he always said, you know, he put on his helmet every day and went out there and he was talking about a army helmet.
Yeah, for sure.
And he taught me earlier, you know, the studio was the enemy, and which they generally were, not always, but. Well, anyway, Robert Aldrich committed to do the movie, and then it didn't work out with Bob. There was a falling out with the studio, and then David, my partner David, was at the Cannes Film Festival, and he saw Ridley Scott's first film.
Wow.
And he thought, you know, this maybe because it looked great and sounded well, and. So we sent the studio, agreed that we could send the script out to Ridley, and he flew in, said, yeah, great. You know, I'd love to do it. He did a wonderful job shooting it, and I think it's his best film. I mean, I know he's done a lot of good work since and all that, but I still think it's his best.
And just the sure-handedness of Ridley as a director, obviously people know that. But, I mean, just when you I made Black Hawk Down with him, and just when you talk to him, just the calmness and just the sure-handedness of the way that he approaches filmmaking – as a producer of producing Ridley Scott, did you find that to be true? How did you guys interact?
Well, I was actually, most of the time, I worked a bit with Ridley in the casting, and the script was already the script.
Right.
I mean, it didn't really change. A few discussions, but I was back and forth to New York and putting together The Warriors, and then The Warriors was being shot at almost exactly the same time.
I see.
As Alien was being shot in London. So I remember when I finished Warriors and I came back to L.A. and we were putting together the first assembly and I flew to London to see the first assembly of Alien, which was, by the way, fabulous. I mean, it was the best first cut I think I've ever seen of anything. I don't think it changed much. Terry Rollins was the film editor. He died, and rest in peace, Terry. very pleasant guy, a real gentleman, and he had put together and he had scored it. The temp tracks were so great. He had been a music editor. The temp music was fabulous, much to the despair always of a composer.
You know, yeah, right, exactly.
The worst thing that can happen
temp love, yeah.
to a composer is that everybody loves the
yeah.
temp score. And we knew we had kind of hit it, you know, and it was gonna do well, we thought. Although we had, I don't have time for this story.
But sure.
We were absolutely convinced that the picture was going to be a big hit. When I say we, the producer and the studio. But you never know until, yeah. you know. And so, and we were part of the, I have to go through the old preview process.
Oh, boy.
Yes. So the studio decides, okay, we're going to do a real first class out of town, you know, newspaper ads out of town. It was before these.
Before NRG and these recruitment services. Yeah.
These are not recruited. It was, you took an ad in the paper, big studio preview tonight, and I think it said science fiction movie or something like that. But you didn't know who was going to be in it and all that kind of. Anyway, they'd use some key art. But anyway, we fly to St. Louis. We're going to do it St. Louis on Friday night, Dallas Saturday night. I can remember we were all drank vodka on the plane going there. And then
nothing's changed, by the way.
Yeah,
I still do the same thing.
Yeah, we were laughing. But, you know, and then we check into the hotel and you go to the bar and have a sharpener. And then you go to the preview, right? And we were very expectant. And the good people of St. Louis just sat there. They had absolutely no reaction at all. They weren't frightened. They weren't. And we didn't have a disgraceful number. We got a pretty good number, but it was just dull. And we couldn't. And so now we go back to the hotel and now we go back to the
drinking
bar.
Drinking for a different reason.
Yeah, drinking with a different
agenda.
Yeah. And where the hell have we gone wrong? And a lot of people saying, oh, if you cut this scene, you cut that and all that. So, and the next morning, everybody hungover, go to the airport, fly to Dallas, get to the hotel, check the paper to see if the ad's the same. Same print. We took the print from St. Louis to same print. Ad was the same. Go to the bar, have a sharpener, and go on to the preview. And the preview was a smash.
Wow.
It was, you know,
amazing.
Knocked them dead.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, the volte fascia on this was so complete that the studio, which had doubts the night before and was, God, do we really have a dog on our hands?
Oh,
we
shit.
Thought it was a...
Right.
Laddie thought possibly after the Dallas preview that the movie was too violent and we might need to cut it back because it was... What had happened was he had gone in a little later and it was one of the first big scares and he was standing at the back of the theater and one of the ushers passed out right in front
of him. Oh, God.
Fell at his feet.
That's amazing.
And so he, you know, he was scared to death. He had been at a very violent preview a few months before with Larry Gordon. Larry had a movie that people had reacted rather savagely to. And that one they were scared of a posse being formed. And, but
coming to the studio.
It's a good movie, by the way, too. Audiences are tricky.
They really are.
Yeah.
And you can't, again, put too much weight one way or the other. Really, it's a guide, and it is you can't hide from it, but you have to use it as a tool as opposed to an – I'll just tell you a really quick story. I did a movie with Spike Lee, and we had a preview, and he vehemently disagreed with the preview audience, and he said, and he was very smart. He said, Todd, they're going to tell you what they want. I don't want to give them what they want. And so if I give them my version of the movie, they may change their idea and decide that's the better movie. He was right. And so the audience is always trying to steer you into sometimes predictability, sometimes the masses kind of always sometimes will steer you maybe in the wrong direction. So thank God you guys did two previews right away and didn't mess with it. Because had you cut all that stuff and previewed it again, and then it was great because it was already a great movie, the movie probably would have been worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, the idea of recutting Alien never really got very far.
Right.
And certainly we didn't support it.
Yeah. I've worked with Ridley. I'm sure he didn't either.
Oh, no. He was a commercial director, and he had made this one movie, which had not exactly been a big commercial success. I think it had a worldwide gross of about $300,000 or something. So, but he was already a confident filmmaker.
Yeah,
he'd shot a lot of.
He still does. Still shoots tons of commercials. Yeah. So, real quickly on the Warriors. Do you shot that in New York?
Yes.
How many days? And it was all nights? How did that?
Almost all nights.
What was the physical production of that movie like? And by the way, what a great year to be Walter Hill, to have Alien and the Warriors.
It was a pretty good year. we shot, I think, 3 days in the Astoria studios. It was all location, except we built a set. I guess it was 2 days. We built a set and did the bathroom fight with the guys in roller skates.
Yeah, gosh, and that changed my life.
And we got a couple of days in there, but the rest of it was nights.
And you were just on the move the whole time? Do you remember how many nights you shot? Sorry, this is the kind of stuff that I just love.
I don't know. I think we shot the movie in about 45 days, something like that. But that was much more. We were way over because there were several things that happened. The studio was furious.
And you cast it with virtually unknowns, correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, it's so great.
It was just our luck. It was the wettest summer in New York in 30 years or so.
Always happens.
Yeah. And there really weren't any cover sets that one could go because we were outdoors all the time. And the other thing was a miscalculation. We had estimated the movie basically like we were shooting it in Los Angeles. The nights in New York, it didn't really get dark enough at that time of year until about 9:30 that you could start shooting. The contract at that time, the IA contract, called for an hour lunch, except under very extraordinary circumstances. And we were, of course, a very low-budget production, so lunches were people would go off to a cafe or something. Mm-hmm. So it was hell getting them back. And then the sun seemed to come up at 4:30 in the morning,
right.
Probably later than that. So we were just getting really a kind of half a day's work out of what we estimated we were going to do in a day.
Right.
So we
it just kept going.
We just kept going.
I wish I had 5 hours to do this with you, sir.
But Larry, of course, the producer of it,
yeah.
Larry Gordon, his fencing with the studio was at a new and masterful level, trying to explain what the hell this director was doing out there.
Right, right. That's, by the way, that nothing has changed. Even today, we're still doing it.
Well, and the other thing is the studio had some goddamn idea that the movie was going to be like Saturday Night Fever.
Right.
You know? And
yeah, sure.
That kind of
a poppy, and then you are just chasing guys down with baseball bats and roller skates and knives and a woman on the radio telling you where they are.
Fantasy of a rather different description.
Such a great movie. I got to be respectful of your time. So how do people get Walter Hill's The Cowboy Iliad, A Legend Told in the Spoken Word?
Well, you call Amazon, iTunes,
perfect.
Spotify, one of those outfits. I mean, I'm still in the days of, as I think I said earlier, Tower Records, where you went down and bought something. And my daughters, my wife says, you know, I still live in the last century. And my daughters contend I live in the 19th century. So it's a mystery to me. But somehow you call those.
Great. Yeah, just look and Google it.
Yeah, right.
And then two questions I always ask. If you had advice for, you said the business is changing exponentially, but still there are certain things that are always going to be good, which is good writing and having taste and having depth and thoughtfulness, and as you show in your writing and everything you do, what advice would you have for new writers coming up?
Well, this is a kind of a shaky time in where it's all going in the business. Is, you know, the theatrical features, as we've understood them, seem to be coming to an end, unless they're big exhibitions of. So I think you just have to have two things, which is you have to believe in yourself because absolutely nobody else will.
For
you
sure.
know, and when you're starting, you must believe in yourself, and you must believe in the power of storytelling, and you must believe in your ability to tell a story in your own way. You know, look. In the smallest village in Tibet and in the smallest hovel at the edge of town, there is a little antenna, and they're in there watching I Love Lucy or something. You know, the human capacity and need for stories is infinite. It's not going away. The delivery systems are changing, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of bumps in the changes of the delivery system. But on the whole, you know, the audience is the audience, and the fashions change, but the need for stories doesn't.
Excellent. And then as a director of all your movies, what was your best day on set?
Oh, I tend not to look back so much. I think I'd like to say maybe it was the first day I did a Western, the first time I got a chance, because I really liked the environment of going out and shooting them. But
which one was it?
Long Riders.
Okay. Do you remember the moment that you're like, man?
Well, I do.
John Ford would be very happy right now.
We were actually shooting the day before we were supposed to start. We decided to do a horse crossing because we had the cameras and all the equipment was there. Why the hell? Let's go out and shoot something. And we decided to do a horse crossing. And it's where Stacy Keach takes a horse across the river. While we were doing it, and it was quite a deep river, while we were doing it, it was Stacy's stuntman. The saddle slipped off the back end of the horse and got caught in the horse's back legs. And the stuntman swam to shore. But the horse started to drown, because it was kicking and couldn't free its legs, so it really couldn't make its kind of dog paddle swim. And the wrangler, the head wrangler, had a little rubber boat thing and shoved off and went out. And you could see this horse was probably going under for the last time. It was just, the sound was terrible, this gasping horse and drowning. And the wrangler, I mean, this is right out of a movie. He's got a lariat. He spins the thing over his head. And we know he's going to have one shot at this.
Wow.
One shot. And if he misses getting the horse, that horse is dead. And he throws the lariat, perfect, around the horse's neck. He pulls the horse up. They get the saddle off the back legs, and the horse swims to, actually, they let it go and it just swam to shore. And I, of course, saw this as a sign.
the optimistic director, yeah, at all times.
If the goddamn horse had drowned, I was finished. But the fact that the horse lived and continued to work for us meant that this thing was going to work out all right.
All right.
And it actually did work out all right.
It was
a pretty good movie, and we certainly had a reasonable time with all the brothers making it.
That's great. Well, as is your career, sir. So thank you, Walter Hill, for coming in. Please, everybody, get the Walter Hill, the Cowboy Iliad. Listen to it. It is a masterclass in writing and so entertaining to listen to you tell the story, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.